ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What does it mean to be a proper man or a proper woman or to be a person who defies the conventions of gender? Lots of us are asking these questions, testing these boundaries today, which means we have much in common with some of Shakespeare's most famous characters. From a woman who's infuriated by her own womanhood.
Come, you spirits, that tend on mortal thoughts. Unsex me here.
To a rebel who apparently relents her defiance of the rules and advises women to know their place.
Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee.
Elizabeth Taylor towing the line as Katerina in The Taming of the Shrew, and before that, Judi Dench in Macbeth. This is Wherefore Shakespeare, the series in which we ask wherefore or why Shakespeare wrote what he did. I'm Michael Cathcart, and today it's all about Shakespeare and gender. So let's start with Twelfth Night, which is the play in which Shakespeare takes most delight in throwing the conventions of gender and sexuality to the wind. Professor Jane Montgomery Griffiths is an actor. She's performed Twelfth Night for Bell Shakespeare. She's also head of performing arts at CollArts, the Australian College of the Arts, in Melbourne. Jane, this play opens with a very famous line.
Oh, if music be the food of love, play on.
Yes, Lucino is sort of lounging around at this sensuous party, encouraging the musicians to play the music of love. And in comes a shipwrecked girl called Viola, disguised as a boy. And before you know it, he's employed her to carry Orsino's romantic messages to the lovely Lady Olivia, who lives, I don't know, on the other side of the square or the other side of town. What's the significance of the title Twelfth Night?
Well, of course, Twelfth Night is when all mayhem breaks loose. Traditionally, it was the night of the year when servants were able to interchange their roles with masters. When there could be chaos, there was sort of controlled anarchy and sometimes not so controlled. So we see that peppered through the play. There are role inversions in terms of class and status, some in terms of gender. And of course, what the play does, well, I mean, we should preface this by saying when Shakespeare was writing, all female parts were played by boys. So already we have that interesting gender performativity and gender subversion going on.
So in this play, there's a lovely joke because you've got a girl who's actually being played by a boy who disguises herself, oh, as a boy.
Yeah.
So already we're in a hall of mirrors before the story's even started.
Oh, absolutely. And it's what we would call now a very sort of queer performativity, in that things that we think are stable, such as gender, such as biology, are now upended through the sort of, the subversive lens of theatre.
Let's go to a scene, it's actually my favourite scene in the play, where Viola has come along as the messenger, dressed as a boy, to Olivia's house, bearing a message from her would-be lover, Orsino. And Olivia sort of toys with her for a while, and then Olivia says, all right, let's hear what he has to say. You're here with a message. What does he have to say?
How does he love me?
With adorations. Fertile tears, with groans that thunder love, with sighs of fire.
Your lord does know my mind. I cannot love him. Yet I suppose him virtuous, know him noble, of great estate, of fresh and stainless youth, in voices well divulged, free, learned and valiant, and in dimension and the shape of nature a gracious person. But yet I cannot love him. He might have took his answer long ago.
If I did love you in my master's flame, with such a suffering, such a deadly life, in your denial I would find no sense. I would not understand it.
Why? What would you?
Make me a willow cabin at your gate, and call upon my soul within the house. Write loyal cantons of contemned love, and sing them loud even in the dead of night. Hello your name to the reverberate hills, and make the babbling gossip of the air cry out, Olivia! Oh, you should not rest between the elements of air and earth, but you should pity me.
You might do much.
Jessica Tovey as Olivia and Emily Edwards as Viola in that scene from Twelfth Night, recorded for us by Bell Shakespeare. So this is very fluid, Jane. Sexual attraction's taking many guises here. What's just happened?
Do you know what I think is so fascinating in this scene, and particularly fascinating about Olivia's attraction to Viola, who is dressed as a boy, and she's calling herself Cesario. We see her moving through the romantic, cliched tropes of love that she knows that Orsino has given her to pass on to Olivia. But because Viola is herself in love with Orsino, and this is deeply, deeply painful for her, she's pressing the suit of the man with whom she's desperately in love to the other woman. And so when Viola gets into Make Me a Willow Cabin, I think the reason that it speaks so resonantly to Olivia is because it's actually her own language. It's her own pain. It's her own poignancy. All of the cliché is gone. It's something which is true and raw, poignant and exquisite.
And what confidence Shakespeare has to know he can pull that off.
Oh,
that he
sure.
can write the Hallmark greeting card over here yep. and then do the stuff that comes straight from the heart.
But you know what's so interesting about Olivia's response, and I'm saying this as an actress who played her many, many years ago and is also gay. What I found fascinating with Olivia is that she has this speech just before saying, look, I can't love Orsino. I mean, I know he's gorgeous. I know he's rich. I know he's everything. There's just something about him. Just can't, don't know what it is, but yeah, nah, sorry. And then Viola's speech and she thinks, oh my God. So what's so interesting for Olivia is she attracted to Viola the woman? Or is she attracted to Cesario the man? Or is she attracted to what we would now call the fluidity of a non-binary identity?
Also with us is Professor David McInnes, who teaches Shakespeare Studies at the University of Melbourne. What do you make of this speech? Are you on side with Jane's reading?
Absolutely. I think what's so interesting is the contrast here. When Olivia describes herself and itemises her own beauties, and she talks about her lips and her eyes and all those sort of features of her own physicality, Olivia is speaking in the language of love poetry, Petrarchan love poetry, the sonnet sequence, which ironically objectifies the woman and disempowers her, and it's all about the male gaze and how you look at a woman and consume that beauty. And then we contrast that with Viola speaking from the heart. And Viola actually understands the raw emotion of and being in love. She's not learning from a book. She's actually giving voice to her genuine emotional response here. So it's a beautiful moment of compare and contrast between these two women's representation of love.
But wait, there's more, because before you know it, Orsino is becoming rather enchanted with this young messenger as well.
That's right.
Our collaborators in this series are Bell Shakespeare, Australia's leading Shakespeare company, and the artistic director is Peter Evans. Hello, Peter. Welcome back.
Oh, hello. Hello. Lovely to see you all.
In a recent Bell production of Twelfth Night, you had a man playing viola. What did that give you? Why did you do that?
Well, the director, Heather Fairbairn, was particularly interested in queering the play. We had Jane cast as Malvolio, where we actually changed the gender of that character. She was also interested in giving the audience, I guess, a look at the way it would have been in Shakespeare's day. So at one level, it was kind of an intellectual exercise, where, in fact, we see a boy dressed as a girl then dressing as a boy. But it also just added, because we then cast a female actor as Sebastian, Viola's twin brother. And so in a sense, the whole thing was queered, I guess, to really point up the fluidity of gender and attraction.
So, Pete, how fluid do you think Shakespeare's ideas of gender are in plays like this? I mean, are we bringing our 21st century fascination with the complexities of gender to this, or do you feel as though they're inherent in the play?
Oh, I think they're completely inherent to play, and I think that would have been fascinating for his audience. I mean, what we've been describing so far happens in most of the plays, and a lot of that's to do with power, that the women are dressing as boys for safety or in order to get a job. But what happens is that it liberates them. So as we were talking about in Twelfth Night, what happens is Viola is liberated by her costume or by her disguise, and so she becomes incredibly attractive to everybody just because she finds a kind of freedom in it.
And as you're saying, this is not unique to Twelfth Night. This does happen in other plays. So where else do we see this kind of playing with gender?
Well, As You Like It is probably the other most famous example. And again, the reason that Rosalind dresses as a boy is in order for safety, because they're heading off into the forest. But when she bumps into her love object, Orlando, it gives her a freedom and she ends up playing with him and playing with language and playing with the tropes of love. And so she discovers something about herself. And I think this is an entirely highly intentional. And as I mentioned, this is to do with sort of power, and it's very sexy.
And of course, we also have Imogen in Cymbeline. So she, poor love, her husband, oh God, where do we start? Her husband has been conned into thinking that she's been unfaithful. And so her husband, who's off in exile, gets their faithful servant to take her into the woods and murder her. So we get, I mean, it's very, very fairy tale-like, this play. And through various shenanigans, she ends up, funnily enough, with her long-lost brothers and a dead husband, she thinks, who's not dead husband, but she ends up dressing as a boy because now she has no life left. She believes her husband to be dead. She's exiled from the court. And her donning of the male clothes is unlike, I think, in all of the cross-dressing parts in Shakespeare. This is both about safety, but it's also about despair. It's as though she is now denuding herself of everything that was her identity as a virtuous wife, because there's nothing else for her.
Now let me ask you the question I just asked Pete, and that is this in Shakespeare's intentions, do you think, or do you think this is a reading that comes to light because of your 21st century position?
The issue of safety is absolutely there. I mean, let's not forget that for Viola, for Rosalind, for Imogen...
So gender and safety.
Absolutely. Without male guardianship, they are intensely vulnerable.
What about this idea of sexual attraction that's not conventional?
Well, I do think that is absolutely implicit. And Shakespeare is, of course, he's loving the double entendre. And coming back to the issue of the casting of these plays, we really see this when you have a single sex cast. So Declan Donlan's famous As You Like It back in the 90s was a revelation, because suddenly the absolute subversion and queerness going on in this play became apparent. Of course, it's a real bummer for actresses, though, because, you know, you spend your early 20s wanting to play Rosalind and then you discover that Adrian Lester's doing it. What the? It really irks actresses, I have to say. And it's interesting, at the same time that there was all of this push in the 90s and early noughties to have all-male casts in Shakespeare, some all-female casts did Shakespeare, and they were all criticised by reviewers for being like school plays. So it's okay when the boys do it, it's not okay when the girls do it, until Phyllida Lloyd came along and did the famous productions with Harriet Walter at the Donmar.
David McInnes, let's move on. Let's leave comedy behind here and go to a play in which the conventional ideas of gender are really given a good shaking. That's Macbeth. And the person who's rattling the orthodoxies here is the treacherous Lady Macbeth herself. So the play opens famously with three witches conspiring. Fair is foul and foul is fair, hover through the fog and filthy air. And shortly afterwards enter two noblemen, Macbeth and Banquo, all bloody from battle, all high on triumph. And it always seems to me that the moment when they meet the witches, right here at the start of the play, they're somehow no longer in control. I mean, these guys think that they rule the world, and suddenly they're in the presence of something they don't quite understand. David, what's going on here?
The witches are such an unusual stage presence in Shakespeare because, as we've been talking about female roles being played by boy actors typically, this is the exception where we have bearded women on stage who seem to be performed by adult male actors rather than boys. So the gender ambiguity is really being ramped up in this particular scene, and I think it's a very deliberate calling attention to this ambiguous status, this ontological status of the witches as being otherworldly and transcending usual human categories. And so really,
we don't allow the word ontological in this. What does ontological mean?
To do with being, the identity effectively. Right.
So press on, Professor.
It undoes received notions of gender. You're talking about a hyper-masculine world in terms of the military success of Macbeth and Banquo, and suddenly they're on the heath, they're outside of civilization, and they're encountering three bodies that defy typical conventions, and not in the kind of sexy way that we've seen boy actors playing attractive female leads in Shakespearean comedies.
No, this is not about sex.
No.
It's all about
Confusion. And something that's a bit potentially sinister or otherworldly or unknowable.
Well, actually, a world where unalloyed masculinity is no longer triumphant,
that's
because
right.
These beings hold all the trump cards.
Mm.
They know what's what. They know what's coming. Anyway, let's move on to the famous bit where gender is really in play. Peter Evans, Duncan, who's the victorious king, he's the king who's won the battle thanks to generals like Macbeth and so on. He's at the Macbeth's palace as the guest of honour. And Macbeth and his wife, rather unsportingly, have plotted to kill him so that Macbeth can take the place of the king. And during the meal, when they're entertaining him, Macbeth steps outside. So why does he go outside the room?
Macbeth starts to have doubts while they're having dinner, and he leaves and has a very famous soliloquy where he kind of works through the arguments and tries to weigh up whether he can rationalise it or justify it on any level. And he can't. He can come up with no actual reason. Anyway, once he's resolved not to, Lady Macbeth comes and finds him and asks him why he's left the banquet.
Yes, let's hear that scene.
What beast was then that made you break this enterprise to me? When you durst do it, then you were a man. And to be more than what you were, you would be so much more the man. Nor time nor place did then adhere, and yet you would make both. They have made themselves, and that their fitness now does unmake you. I have given suck, and know how tender 'tis to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out, had I so sworn as you have done to this.
If we should fail.
We fail. But screw your courage to the sticking place, and we'll not fail.
Jessica Tovey as Lady Macbeth, Hazem Shammas as Macbeth in that recording from Bill Shakespeare. What do you make of that speech, Jane?
The whole issue of what comprises man and woman through this speech is unpacked in such a fascinating way. And let's not forget that Lady Macbeth, in the first scene that we see her, after she's received the news of the witches talking to Macbeth, she has the speech, "Come you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty." But then, I mean, as an actor, I mean, certainly I found this when I played Lady M, you then think, but this is also a woman who has given suck. This is a woman who has given birth, who then is prepared to say, were our dead baby alive, I would take that baby and smash its brains
not
out.
Not just pluck it from my nipple.
Pop it for, yes. Well, it was smiling in my face.
And dash its brains out, had I sworn as you have done
to this. It's quite extraordinary.
David McInnes, there's a tantalising echo of this speech we've been discussing. In a famous speech that Queen Elizabeth gave in 1588, she was delivering it to her army at Tilbury, which is just outside central London at the mouth of the Thames. And they were gathering to meet the invading forces carried by the Spanish Armada. And she's on a white horse dressed as the goddess Athena. She gives them a very rousing speech, and then she says, "I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too."
Very theatrical, isn't it? But of course, she's actively engaging with the performance of gender, and she's knowingly operating in the shadow of her very famous father, Henry VIII, and that kind of hyper-masculinity and that fixation on siring a male child and all that sort of toxic masculinity, really. And she's trying to invert a lot of those tropes, and she's trying to find ways to celebrate her femininity and to actively think about owning her gender and seeing, you know, it's a set piece, right? She's appearing on a horse, even though she has no intention of actually riding that
charging
into battle.
Charging into battle.
Right? But that, the ceremony dictates that's how she should appear as the monarch. Right? That's it. So she's thinking very clearly about what it means to be a woman who is the monarch and how she can do her own PR campaign effectively. So thinking about the performance of gender, which is what Lady Macbeth is thinking about that moment too. And, you know, that Lady Macbeth speech with Macbeth we just looked at a moment ago, though, is really interesting because on one hand she's laying aside her biological gender or attempting to do so and owning that and saying, "I can transcend this." On the other hand, she's actively playing into the performance of gender by manipulating Macbeth's sense of masculinity and his pride that's bound up with his gender identity. And she's shaming him. She's saying, "Be more of a man." And she knows that's his pressure point. If she can make him feel bad about the way he operates as a man in society, that's the way to get to his heart and manipulate him.
Let's turn briefly, if we could, now to The Taming of the Shrew, which is the most vexing, problematic play, I think. And let's see what we can make of this. Problematic when it comes to gender. So the shrew in the title is Kate, the headstrong, wild, angry, I guess beautiful daughter of a wealthy merchant. And along comes a cocky fellow named Petruchio, who's a wealthy man with a hearty appetite for women and for wine and money. And he decides that he's going to marry Kate, but first he's going to break her. As if she were a horse, I guess. Let's give ourselves a sense of how this dynamic works between these two. What scene should we hear, Peter?
Well, I wonder if the first time they meet might be the most interesting, where the proposition, I'm going to marry you, and Kate saying, you're absolutely not going to, and it's all delivered in banter. And so the first two-thirds of the scene could really be from one of the other comedies. But then when he drops the hammer and said, I've spoken to your father, this is just going to happen, it just switches into something that I think is quite terrifying.
Mm. All right, let's hear that.
Come, come, you wasp. In faith, you are too angry.
If I be waspish, best beware my sting.
My remedy is then to pluck it out.
Aye, if the fool could find it where it lies.
Who knows not where a wasp does wear his sting? In his tail.
In his tongue.
Whose tongue?
Yours, if you talk of tails. And so farewell.
What? With my tongue in your tail? Nay, come again, good Kate. I am a gentleman.
That I'll try.
Oh, I swear I'll cuff you if you strike again.
So may you lose your arms. If you strike me, you are no gentleman. And if no gentleman, why, then no arms.
Nay, come, Kate, come. You must not look so sour.
It is my fashion when I see a crab.
Why, here's no crab, and therefore look not sour.
There is. There is.
Then show it me.
Had I a glass, I would.
What? You mean my face?
Well aimed of such a young one.
Now, by St. George, I am too young for you.
Yet you are withered.
'Tis with cares.
I care not.
Hear you, Kate. Setting all this chat aside, thus in plain terms, your father hath consented that you shall be my wife, your dowry agreed on, and will you, nill you, I will marry you.
James Evans as Petruchio laying down the law, and Emily Edwards as Kate in that scene from The Taming of the Shrew. Now, in that scene, it does feel like it could work, doesn't it?
Well, it could be Beatrice and Benedict, couldn't it?
Yes.
Much ado.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It's, yeah. You know, they're witty. They're a match for each other.
Yeah. Well, look, I've got a problem with the play.
What's that?
I've actually been in a conversation, and Germaine Greer has a very contrarian view of the play and finds it completely sexy from Woe to Go. But I have to admit that I am yet to be convinced that this plays actually worth putting on, controversially or not.
I mean, the action's very easy to summarise. You've got the man who wants to marry Kate. He basically wears her down by starving her, locking her up, doing all these terribly violent and unacceptable things to her until eventually it seems she yields, and then he marries her. And having married her, he then won't stay for the marriage night. He says, oh, I've got business over in some other place, and off he goes. And then she gives this speech at the end in which she says, thy husband is thy lord, thy life thy keeper, thy head thy sovereign. She's saying to all the women, actually, boys are okay, they look
and
after you.
And puts her hand under his foot in sign of submission. But of course, what's so interesting about that is that that is the rhetoric, that is a Christian rhetoric.
But can we have it, Jane?
I have seen several productions of it. The one that I found bizarrely most successful was when Kate's speech was done completely straight. It was Sinead Cusack and Alan Armstrong back in the RSC, back in the 80s. And there's a scene when finally Petruchio has agreed to bring Kate back home to her father's house to celebrate her sister's wedding. And Petruchio, it's the classic scene of gaslighting. Petruchio makes Kate say that the sun is the moon and the moon is the sun. And for these actors in this moment, they both looked at each other and they both started laughing, the characters, the actors, whatever it was. But it was an exquisite moment of relief for the audience, because you realised that it was as though Kate realised that this whole thing had just been a really sick joke. And then they suddenly fell in love with each other in that moment. Now,
But this is the guy who says, I'm not sure it's in that scene, but he says to all assembled, she is my goods, my chattel, she is my house, my household stuff.
Mm. Oh, it's appalling. And I felt very compromised actually enjoying the production because it was as though they both realised that they'd been idiots. And then the Kate's final speech was simply because she wanted them to win the money.
Okay, so but what's your point? One production pulls it off.
Yeah, but other ones, no. For other productions, it has absolutely been straight down the line as a production about domestic violence. And there it was irredeemable.
David.
Look, I think scholars and directors have done mental gymnastics trying to make this play palatable and justify why they want to put it on. I think that the harsh reality is it is awful in terms of the gender dynamics. And I think it was known as such in its own lifetime. Shakespeare's friend and fellow playwright John Fletcher writes a sequel called The Tamer Tamed, in which Caterina has died and Petruchio has remarried and he's being tamed by his second wife. And when that play was being performed at court in front of King Charles and Henrietta Maria, Taming of the Shrew was liked, but The Tamer Tamed was well-liked. So there was a sense in that time even that we needed a kind of a proto-feminist sequel to this play that was just retrograde already.
So where does this leave us vis-a-vis Shakespeare? How could Shakespeare write Twelfth Night and write this?
But is it not a cultural thing? You know, is it not a cultural, but when legally women were chattels until the 19th century?
No, I don't think that's an answer because Shakespeare, in some extent, is above culture. He's an artist. He's looking at culture. How can he be so very orthodoxly patriarchal in this play when he was so fluid in Twelfth Night and is in the sonnets,
but
for example?
But you could say bums on seats. I mean, it's an awful thing, but it was only in the 1970s we were laughing at Bernard Manning.
But also, I think this is potentially one of the very first plays he wrote. And I think we can see an evolution of sophistication in Shakespeare's writing, technically, but also in terms of themes and in terms of gender.
David, as we wind up, I wonder what you make of this, because you're teaching Shakespeare studies. Do you look at each of the plays as a thing unto itself or a product of its culture in conversation with other texts, you know, other plays of the period? Or are you interested in what the organising intelligence of this man Shakespeare is and how he is present throughout the plays with ideas that change and morph? Are you interested in that relationship between the author and the work?
I am, to the extent that Shakespeare is a commercial playwright who knew how to put bums on seats. He was a shareholder in his company as well as an actor and a playwright, so he knew what sold. And I think he was a very canny businessman and artist. And the word you used before was artistry, and I think that's the key to understanding how this man could write both Taming of the Shrew and Twelfth Night. Taming the Shrew is it's a genre piece. There are a whole series of shrew taming plays from this period, including another one called The Taming of a Shrew, which is almost identical. So Shakespeare very clearly following the vogue and doing what's popular at the time. He goes with the trends. He has to be very sensitive to market demands and what's working.
Oh, let's end on that tantalising proposition, because next time we're going to talk about horror and terror. And as we'll find out, there are some similar impulses driving that work as well. Thank you to all three of you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been meeting Professor Jane Montgomery Griffiths, who's an actor and head of performing arts at CollArts, the Australian College of the Arts in Melbourne, Professor David McInnes, who teaches Shakespeare Studies at the University of Melbourne, and Pete Evans, who's the head of Bell Shakespeare, our partners in this series. And yes, in the next instalment of Wherefore Shakespeare, you'll be entering Shakespeare's House of Horrors as we explore some of his bloodiest and most gory plays and ask, when was Shakespeare having fun exploiting the human appetite for horror stories? And when was he taking us to the genuinely dark places of the human soul? Wherefore Shakespeare is produced for ABCRN by Kim Jurek. And I'm Michael Cathcart. See you next time. Bye-bye.